Akela, do you remember 1990?
Very vaguely. I was 5 years old.
Well, that's you're very lucky. Unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember 1990 in some detail. That was the year that German reunification was formally formalised. Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and neoliberalism was in full effect here in Australia with Prime Minister Bob Hawke as its avatar. And history had ended, according to Francis Fukuyama, and we were in a post-political world of never-ending abundance. Can you imagine how wonderful it was to be alive then?
Totally wonderful. Things have just gone downhill.
1991, which we're about to come into, also marks the 30th anniversary of the launch of the Green Left newspaper. Quite an achievement. And today we have Pip Hinman and Susan Price, co-editors of the paper, joining us on the Green Left podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
2021 marks 30 years of Green Left. Can you tell us about the origins of the paper and how it was first set up?
Yeah, well, I'll kick it off because I was part of the origin of the Green Left. I guess that was the period that the collapse, the Soviet Union had collapsed well and truly. And I guess a lot of us, some of us were working in the predecessor of Green Left called Direct Action. And we were interested in broadening out the scope of the discussion that we thought was needed on the progressive left. And I guess the name Green Left encapsulated to us how we thought the movement needed to go. So broadly speaking, the green side of the movement needed to talk more with the left side of the movement and get out of perhaps a bit of a bubble which existed then. But also on top of that, there was the whole collapse of communism. You couldn't talk about it. It was, as you said, that was the end of history. The rest of it, the rest of the propaganda was going on. So the idea came about that we launch a new paper for the left and progressive movements, which was not specifically a party paper, but nevertheless had a core of committed activists ensuring that we'd come out. And we wanted to involve more people who weren't necessarily identifying, per se, with an organised part of the left. And so Green Left started up during the Gulf War, Second Gulf War, with a lot of broader support from activists involved in a range of movements.
I've still got my Green Left Weekly Share, or Green Left Share Certificate, actually.
Wow. Hang on to that. That could be your meal ticket into retirement, into the sunset, Susan. Maybe, Susan, take us back to 1990. What was the media landscape like, and what was the state of left independent media back then? From my recollection, 1990 was a pretty bleak period. Is acceptance of progressive or left-wing ideas greater now than it was back in 1990, or am I maybe misreading it?
Well, I think the mood of the time was very much influenced by what had happened in Eastern Europe, and there was a bit of a kind of collective depression at that time. But then it's always contradictory, because then at the same time you had the rise of green parties around the world. So there was a new movements forming particularly around ecology, and that had its resonance in Australia too. I mean, when Green Left was launched, it was in the period prior to the formation of the Australian Green Party, where a lot of local experimenting was going on with alliances of ecological, social-minded, humanistic, some former communist activists and others who were looking for, I guess, a new way forward for, political change here. So I think that was why, timing-wise, it was, Green Left was really trying to capture the mood, that mood of the moment. So at the same time, seeking to explain what had gone on in the Soviet Union, why things had ended up the way they had, but also not allowing, that event to frame politics for the future. So looking to try to relate to the new movements, and in particular to break through what was a very concentrated ownership of media in Australia. I mean, you could actually say nowadays, in many ways, the mainstream media, capitalist media, is far more concentrated in ownership than it was back then. But back then it was terrible. And you didn't have widespread mass use of the internet. and social media then either. So news was very filtered through the capitalist press. So it meant that Green Left played a really important role in trying to be a voice of the unheard.
You mentioned mainstream media. Are you feeling that independent publications like Green Left have more responsibility? Does that, you're feeling greater pressure on you as journalists?
Oh, well, everyone's a journalist these days. So in a way, the digital landscape allows us to access a lot more journalism, especially on the spot reports. Yeah, so I think, yeah, I mean, there's two sides of that. Yes, we'd like more resources for investigative journalism, and that's something that a not-for-profit always finds hard. Nevertheless, we have the upside, which is that everyone's a journalist, even if they don't realise it. When they're going to things and reporting on things and taking their photos and passing it around the internet, we're having trouble keeping up with reporting on all the things that are happening.
Yeah.
We're really limited by resources and capacity to involve more people in the project, actually, which we would certainly like to do, because I think that's the future.
Speaking of people becoming involved in the project, Susan, if a person was to come across Green Left online or in print and feel like they wanted to write for you or just, you know, be a part of the project, how do you get involved?
Well, it's actually very simple. In fact, every week we get unsolicited contributions from readers, people who've come across Green Left and like what we publish and have an interest in a particular area that they want to write about. We get people who pitch to us ideas for stories. And I guess the other side of it, you know, there's contributions, but at the same time, there's other ways that people can support the project. They can write for it. They can also help get it around, whether that's by physically distributing it or sharing it on social media. And I think the thing that's really what's allowed Green Left to survive for the last 30 years has actually been a huge fundraising effort by readers, by supporters, particularly members of the Socialist Alliance, who have, you know, really been the backbone of financial fundraising for Green Left over the three decades. So, yeah, attending a comedy, you know, performance or other events that we hold from time to time to raise money for Green Left. I mean, one of the most recent ones we've just done in the last weekend was a fascinating, you know, event in discussion with Bruce Pascoe, the author of Dark Emu. So these are the sorts of things where people can, you know, be a part of Green Left, whether they want to write for it or just be involved somehow in the project.
That's really interesting, and it's obviously the case that you've had to respond to the kind of shifting social and political environment through the way in which your paper reaches people. People, would you like to tell us a bit about how you've responded to the changing environments?
Yeah, well, podcasting is one big aspect of this. We've been trialling podcasts now for few years, and some supporters of Green Left also are involved in radio programs. But we are coinciding with our 30th year, about to launch, I guess, a new chapter of Green Left, which is, you know, more consistent podcasting programs in a number of places. So I think this is going to connect with particularly younger people who perhaps find reading huge slabs of text Not necessarily difficult, but difficult to fit into their day, because, you know, casual workers generally running from shifts and all sorts of other things in their lives find it hard to perhaps do what we may once have found easier. And listening to podcasts, both which are chatty or historical or whatever, short stories even, could be a way of reaching people. I mean, I think, having said that everyone's a journalist these days, I think there is big pressure on people to still work out what they're reading. Is it real? Is it not real? I think there's a big element of that. There's so much that's surreal that goes on, and I guess, and is reported as fact. And so I guess the other element that Green Left is trying to do, both in the print copy, online and podcasts, would be to help people analyse the world as it is, to be able to work out what are the next steps for, say, progressive change. I think that's probably where Green Left, you know, comes in comes in is something that we treasure and keep striving to do, because there's a lot of commentary going on. There's, everyone's got a comment, an opinion, whatever. It's not necessarily grounded, in fact. But we're not interested in just reporting that. We're interested in trying to actually also talk to people that are making proposals about next steps. So I guess Green Left is more than a newspaper or a magazine in that sense. It's trying to be an active agent in supporting progressive change.
That's really interesting. And I'd like to hear a bit more about the political projects, because it sounds like Green Left is not just a newspaper but has a strong grassroots community focus. And Susan, just wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about what impact Green Left might have had on these movements in the past, and how it engages with grassroots movements.
Well, I think part of the project has always been about building the social movements, not just in Australia but also internationally. And so we've always sought to not just carry news about protests, rallies, that kind of thing, but also debates in the movement. I suppose one probably in the recent past that I think was extremely important, because no one else was really talking about it, was the critique that was coming through the pages of Green Left and online about the emissions trading schemes discussions going on in Australia under particularly the Rudd-Gillard government, and the push to go to carbon credits and cap and trade schemes. And, you know, within the environment movement, there was a real lack of debate on the problems with market-based solutions such as emissions trading schemes to taking the, you know, urgent action on climate change that was needed. So I think Green Left actually played a really key role in that discussion. And I think too, in connecting activists with, you know, like struggles in different states and around the country, linking up grassroots climate action groups with each other. Also refugee, Green Left's played a very important role in keeping the whole question of refugee rights, mandatory detention, you know, in the centre of public awareness. And this was in the days when, you know, there was almost a virtual blackout in the mainstream press on a lot of these issues. I think it's changed now, thankfully. But also building awareness and solidarity with revolutionary and social change struggles internationally. Because, you know, for anyone who consumes mainstream media, to actually find out what's really going on in the world is impossible unless you're a bit of a sleuth and can follow up leads yourself. But at Green Left, you know, we've sort of prided ourselves, I think, on bringing the news that the mainstream media won't report to people, and in particular about the revolutionary struggles in Latin America, you know, even the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, which wasn't always as well known and supported as it is today, certainly not by the Australian government, who basically accused, you know, figures like Nelson Mandela of being a terrorist at the time when the anti-apartheid movement was happening. Yeah, so I think that's actually been a very important role, and where we've sought to influence. I guess the test of whether we have had influence is, in a way, something that happens in hindsight, but we're certainly trying to have influence as much as we can over debates, discussion of strategy, and people's awareness of what's going on out there and all the lessons that can be learned from the various struggles going on across the country and internationally.
Yeah, I mean, we've done things like place correspondents in Venezuela precisely because there was just no coverage of what was happening there. We just thought, this is crazy. There's a revolution unfolding under Hugo Chavez, and the progressive movement, the English-speaking progressive movements, the ones that weren't following Spanish, were just not aware of what was being pioneered in that country. So, you know, we had a correspondent there. We had a correspondent in South Africa. And we also sent correspondents, looking at the first issue of Green Left, to Prague as the, as the USSR and affiliates were collapsing. So we really were keen on presenting data.
I'm keen on one of those foreign correspondent jobs, if there's any going. I mean, I'm ready. I can pack my bags and be on a... I can be at the airport tomorrow if you got
West Papua, I reckon. That'd be a good place to go.
Indeed. I'll bring it back to the local scene again and ask you about the Greens, who are having something of a moment. You know, the Greens, as they were as they grew from sort of the 1990s, they grew out of, I guess, and they still are very much an inner city demographic. What's the critiques you hear of the Greens from the mainstream media, from the right, are always just hysterical nonsense. But the critique of the Greens as they stand here today from the perspective of Green Left, how are they doing? Let's give them a scorecard.
Whoa. Not sure. Well, look, I mean, Green Left covers the Greens positively in general. Because we share a lot of the same sorts of immediate goals. And the Greens are promoting right now in the climate, in the debate over targets for 2030, the Greens are absolutely spot on saying we need net zero emissions from energy by 2030 if we're even going to stick to roughly the roadmap that Paris is saying we need to. So the Green Left is reporting on what the Greens are saying and doing in Parliament, sometimes in local council. And we know that, you know, the Greens are a bigger movement than just the inner city. There's actually a lot of people now in regional areas that are supporting the Greens because the Nationals are not at all representing them. So, yeah, I think... some of us individually probably have criticisms of the fact that the Greens sort of just fall short of discussing the system that leads to runaway climate change, that leads to sexism, racism and all the rest of it, capitalism. And that's where Green Left seeks to help people understand why all these crazy, idiotic policies are being adopted and what the pressures are on policymakers. But I think in general, as far as transitional demands go in terms of day-to-day politics, I think, you know, we would support a lot of what the Greens are saying and doing. Right. I guess our other difference would be that if any of us were in a similar sorts of positions, we would be using those platforms to put a lot more energy and work into building movements on the ground for social change, because ultimately you can pass a lot of happy motions in Parliament.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get there.
Okay, so I'm just looking at a copy of Green Left right now, and at the top on the header it says for eco-socialist action. So I'm wondering, in the context of the climate crisis we are facing, what do you mean by eco-socialist action, and how does the paper facilitate eco-socialist action?
Well, you could say that nothing short of an eco-socialist revolution is going to save humanity. I mean, that's really kind of the stakes. They're pretty high. I mean, if you look, you know, like looking back at some of the early issues of Green Left, I think it was probably the first English-speaking eco-socialist newspaper. And back in March of 1991, our front cover was "The Heat Is On," and it was all about global warming. You know, the IPCC report that was handed down that year, the IPCC had only been in existence for 3 years at that time. So this was really early days of recognition of greenhouse gas impacts on climate change. And ironically, or tragically, you know, within that issue, we were talking about how George Bush Sr. and James Baker were trying to block action around climate change in the international summits that were going on at that time. And, you know, here we are today, nearly 30 years later, with Donald Trump hopefully not in the White House for too long, you know, having completely left the Paris process, and in a situation where we were talking about global warming of 0.3 to 0.6 degrees Celsius back then. But now we're talking about 1.6 degrees of warming. And things are a lot worse, and so many three wasted decades. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess for us, the sort of being very upfront about eco-socialist action is kind of saying action's needed, and we see Green Left as being part of building that kind of political movement that's needed to bring about the change and to challenge the power of the fossil interests if we're going to save humanity and the planet.
Yeah, the stakes are pretty high. What you're saying reminds me of the famous quote by Greta Thunberg, we need, when she's talking about the need for system change, because the system is doing what it's meant to be doing, as she says, which is actually the capitalist program of environmental exploitation. Pip, I wanted to turn to you. You know, about this. You know, as the climate crisis, as Susan said, it's been going on for over 30 years. We've known that things are really bad. Do you feel that the Green Left is more crucial now than ever?
Well, I think the vision that we're trying to hold out with that slogan, which may not be, you know, we try and elaborate on it. The Eco-Socialist Action is also trying to paint a vision for something better. It is, that's, the vision is desperately needed. I mean, I think we need 100 more, a million more types of Green Left, if you like, in all its various incarnations, you know. I mean, we certainly don't think we're the only show in town. We would appreciate it if there was more independent media talking about the same thing, maybe from different angles. Yeah, so in a way, and to answer your question in a short way, yes, I mean, we feel like we're making a contribution, but it's way short of what's needed. Because realistically, for justice, we have to act. We have to force the rich country governments to act in 10 years. Otherwise, I mean, extinction is already on us. We already know what's happening with the impoverished part of the world, which is the majority of the world. We're living in a bubble in Australia in terms of living standards and everything else. The left has got is very comfortable, you'd have to say, in general, and not to say that there aren't a lot of people that are on the breadline and living very badly. But I think we have to keep reminding people in Australia, at least, that you know, we have, there's a lot at stake, but also we have moral responsibility as well to do what we can in the next few years to force some of the changes, because it's not us that's going to be inundated or forced to migrate or whatever, but, you know, we're still going to feel the effects. And so Australia is also one of the biggest contributors to the problem. So per capita, of course, our emissions are very high. We're exporting a lot of coal and gas. Gas is now going to be the recovery export, apparently, and so in that sense we have an obligation as well to step up our game. And so Green Left's trying to do that in every which way that we can, not just through the pages, but our reporters, correspondents, supporters are all, a lot of them are involved in movements on the ground, and I think that's the other part of the overall project. We don't just want to report on things, we want to encourage people to also step in and get involved.
I mean, I know I'm going to encounter people in my orbit over this holiday period who generally seem to think that, you know, capitalism will solve the problem of the climate crisis. I mean, we already see the capitalist class looking for opportunities, you know, everything from greenwashing in an ad campaign to, you know, all sorts of, you know, tech solutions to the climate crisis. So I just wanted to ask you, maybe Susan first, you know, what's some terminology? How do you approach that discussion when people say, look, you know, I'm on board with this whole global warming thing now, and because look what these corporations are doing, and we can all go back to having lunch. How do you counter that argument?
I mean, I think for a lot of people, just going through the experience of the Black Summer bushfires last year was a real confrontation, a real wake-up call that we're not immune from the impacts of climate change. I think that did have a big impact on people, particularly in the eastern states.
Sure.
But, you know, I guess one response to that kind of level of trauma is sometimes to just want to wipe it out of your mind or just pretend that, you know, things can go back to normal, and clearly they can't. You know, I think we've got to take whatever opportunities we can to have the discussions one-on-one with people we know about the fact that corporations, fossil fuel companies will say one thing, you know, give promises that they're going to reform themselves, become sustainable. I mean, a lot of them own a lot of the solar technology that is in existence, for example. But what they actually are doing, on the other hand, is finding whatever ways they can to continue to profiteer from the dirtiest, most polluting industries. Okay, maybe not in a really obvious way in the first world, but they're shifting a lot of that onto the global south, where it's hidden, you know, where you have governments that are quite happy to do the bidding of the big fossil fuel companies, even if it means violently suppressing dissent in those countries. But, you know, this is the thing. I mean, it's so, people just aren't aware of this kind of stuff. So I guess the most important thing is to be patient with people. But I think that what Pip was saying before about the question of vision is really important, because there's an awful lot of bad news out there, and there is a tendency for people to want to turn off. So I think that people need a vision for a kind of different future that I think all of us think about. We think about how life could be better for us and our communities. But then what we need is the pathway for how we're going to get to from where things are today to where they need to be, a pathway out of the climate crisis. And that's, you know, these are the sorts of demands that are being raised by the movement today about having, you know, emissions reduction targets that actually are going to have an impact on global warming into the future. You know, moving to 100% renewables, moving to, you know, phase out coal and gas, and transitioning workers, communities in a just way to a different kind of production, different sorts of work. So, you know, I think that's all part of the equation that's hopefully going to convince people in the end. You know, that's what we're seeking to do anyway.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting thing to ponder, is how gullible are people today about green capitalism compared to, say, 30 years ago?
I'm shocked at the level of gullibility.
Well, I think it probably also relates to people's comfort, where
they're
in their lives.
Yeah. I think people want to believe. They want to believe because it's, you know, the alternative is so horrifying. People want to believe. They're reaching out for this, you know.
Then if they read the science, you see the scientists, who are hardly radicals, scientists are scientists, they're saying we have to shift dramatically.
Mm.
So you read the science and then you compare that with the policy, and there's just a complete, you know, there's no connection there at all. So, I mean, the problem I think we do face is that, you know, it is... Green capitalism is all around us. It's on the ABC. It's everywhere you look. All the progressives are green capitalists. So, you know, that's the mainstream idea now. Mainstream progressive idea is green capitalism. So we have to think for Green Left. How do we both dissect that without looking completely off the planet, so to speak? What we're trying to do is explain that it's not down to you or me recycling better, or getting rid of our cars, or putting rooftop solar on, all the things that I'd like to do but can't afford, it's actually a system issue, and therefore we have to talk about the system.
Yeah. I have on a little bit of paper the top 20 polluting companies in the world, and sometimes I take it to family gatherings and, you know.
Oh, that must make you really popular.
No, I mean, I'm using it in defence. You know, it's like, okay, look, you know, let's get off this, you know, recycling... use buy the right light globes thing, people. This is what we really need to be talking about.
To be fair as well, the environment movement, such as we know it, is so small yet in Australia. So a lot of people that would like to get involved can't see the entry point. They don't know where to go. How do you get involved? I mean, the high school students, when they were mobilising, they gave people an entry point, and you could see immediately mums, dads, aunties, uncles, grandparents, everybody came along to support them. They saw the entry point and they joined in. You know, I do think that the progressive green left in this country is still too small, and that is a pressure on us all the time. We feel it all the time. And I guess getting back to part of the role of green left is to be able to explain some of these things, not in a tut, tut, tut sort of way, but as in an involving... You too can be a part of the change. That's right, the solution.
Capitalism's always going to find ways to, you know, to claim the language or the imagery. I mean, they've been doing that for a long time.
I want to ask you guys about labour, organised labour. I recall the early 90s as the final kind of disassembling of labour power in Australia. So I guess I wanted to ask both of you, where are we at now? Are there any good left-wing unions doing good work, and are they? Is Green Left a mouthpiece for them?
Yeah, I think we've always tried to seek out and amplify the voices of the militant wing of the trade union movement in Australia, and also, I guess, to draw out some of the lessons of that period of the Accord years, and during the 80s in particular, which, you know, by the early 90s, when we saw the amalgamations of unions going on, led to the weak position of organised labour today, that whole process. But that's probably a topic for a whole other discussion. So, yeah, I think we've always been very conscious of reaching out to, collaborating with and encouraging encouraging that wing to grow and to become more influential in the trade union movement. I suppose, I mean, you know, you can certainly look back through the pages of Green Left to some of the interviews that we've done with union figures. Some people who are currently in the leadership of the Maritime Union who are involved in a very progressive rank and file grouping within the Maritime Union back during the early, was it the late 1990s?
That's the MUA, right?
Yes, the MUA, the Maritime Union of Australia. Figures like Craig Johnson, who led a rank and file grouping within the Manufacturing Workers Union, the AMWU, and actually they went on to win the leadership of the Victorian branch of the AMWU. So, I think Green Left has always tried, you know, we see that that's part of our role is... We want to be where unionists are organising. We were certainly very much saw ourselves as pushing the whole Your Rights at Work campaign in the lead up to the 2007 election. In saying that, we not only in promoting what the ACTU and other trades and labour councils were doing at the time, but also running or hosting debate and discussion within the pages of the paper about strategy. And it was quite, you know, often at times very critical of what the ACTU were doing, but allowed the voices of the most militant forces within the union movement at the time to actually have a say. And many of those forces actually did push that campaign much further than it was prepared to go. And it was certainly a very important time, I think, in Australia's trade union history, that period during that campaign. And we sought to, wherever we could, help build industrial action, strikes, mass meetings, to be as democratic, as open, to have as much influence as possible over decisions that were being made about what to do next in that campaign.
It is much harder now, of course. When you look at the wages and profit share graph that we published recently, because we are graphicising that, you know, it's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Wages share of GDP is going down rapidly, right. And profit share is going up, right, dramatically. So the graph is quite dramatic. Mm-hmm. You can find it on the website of Green Left. And I guess alongside of the wages share going down, you actually see corresponding union decline in organised unions. And so it is much, much harder for those, you know, active unionists to both work and organise workplaces and organise against all the anti-union laws that are coming forward. So we are doing our best to try and link up with those people that are still organising.
One of the things that really impressed me about Green Left when I first had a look at it was the focus on international movements around the world. And I just wanted to ask you a question about international solidarity. And what's the role Green Left has played in supporting national liberation movements?
I mean, I think I think Green Left has been critical. We were talking earlier about the fact that the mainstream media, you know, in reporting events, world events, you know, it's all very shallow and you don't really find out very much from reading or listening to mainstream media. But I guess in its early days, in the sort of late 1980s, the struggle for East Timor was going on, and Green Left was very active in giving support to the forces within Timor who were struggling against Indonesian occupation of an independent nation, but also to the broader international solidarity movement of people living in exile and their supporters, particularly in Australia and throughout the world, who were in solidarity with that campaign. So, you know, we took a position from the start that the East Timorese had a right to self-determination and to be free of occupation by Indonesia. And I think that the fact that the Australian government was so involved in giving support to Indonesia to continue that occupation was part of that, but also that it basically green-lighted Indonesia's invasion of East Timor back in the 1970s. I guess that was one of the key struggles that we promoted very heavily, and a lot of our writers and supporters were quite centrally involved in the Timorese campaign, including Pip and myself in different cities at the time. And I suppose more recently, certainly we've had all the Latin American, the Pink Tide governments, and the fact that, you know, we've We've sent people to places like Venezuela to cover those movements, which, you know, you could say are also about national liberation and national sovereignty against imperialist domination. You know, they've been critical struggles for us to support. And in the more recent times, we've spent a lot of pages and space promoting and writing about and educating ourselves and others about the process going on in Rojava in northern Syria, which is really under pressure at the moment because Turkey's invaded that region now and is trying to completely crush that process. So that's been another, I think, important part of the world for us to try to bring to people in Australia.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I think strangely for a rich capitalist country, for a rich capitalist country like Australia, a lot of political people can see politics in another country unfold, whereas they find it harder to see it happening here. So, for instance, you know, the East Timor drew in, the struggle by the East Timorese drew in to the movement here, a lot of younger people. They could see how draconian not just the Indonesian forces were, but the Australian government was sitting on its hands. And so, you know, from the point of view of, you know, we felt it was our duty to support, and it was, to support the Timorese in their just struggle for self-determination, we could also see that it was part of involving more people in the struggle here. And, of course, you know, that same thing probably applies to the current struggles of West Papua. A lot of young people in Australia looking at West Papua are thinking, what the hell is going on there? Why can't these people just fly their flag? So I think, you know, that's that's an element too for us, that often people coming into politics will see struggles overseas and relate to that. I mean, we tend to view we view national self-determination struggles as part of overall struggle for democracy. And so a lot of people relate to basic democratic rights and less so about whether a national movement for independence has the absolutely correct program and is following it.
That is refreshing to, you know, the fact that there's a new generation of people who are looking beyond, you know, purity and just looking at people's basic struggles and why can't they achieve even a shadow of what we enjoy here. Well, we might move towards a conclusion here. It's been a fantastic chat. Now, 30 years is an amazing achievement in any endeavour, let alone trying to run a newspaper and cover all these vitally important stories both here and overseas. Absolutely amazing achievement and huge props to you and your crew, Pip and Susan.
A lot of crew over the 30 years.
I'm sure. Now you have a social media promotion we're getting up and running. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes. Well, we're asking people to send us some happy birthday messages. So we've set up a hashtag called #GreenLeft30, not too complicated, and we're asking readers, supporters out there to record a little message, use the hashtag, post it to your social media feed, Twitter, Facebook, Insta, take a little photo of yourself, and in the latest issue of Green Left, we've even included a poster that you can hold and get someone to take a picky of you, and then you can send us a picture if you'd like to, along with your message, just telling us what Green Left means to you, and we'll try and publish as many of them as we can and share them around on social media.
Okay, so it's hashtag
#GreenLeft30.
#GreenLeft30.
You can send via the website. Via email if you like to editor@greenleft.org.au or post it on Twitter using the hashtag or Facebook using the hashtag, and we'll collect it.
Fantastic. Thanks again for all the work you do, and here's to another 30 years. So we'll sign off now from the Green Left podcast. Thank you, Markella.